You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca and the Huron-Wendat First Nations. We always remember that every week, that whose land we're actually on. Every week, we read one of the 94 resolutions by the Truth and Reconciliation Committee, which seeks to address the enormous wrongs committed by our population against First Nations peoples. We read one each week in order to remain aware of our treaty obligations and the relationship we have with our First Nations sisters and brothers. We read one of the 94 recommendations sent to all levels of government by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We expect to complete these readings in June 2017. Recommendation number 28. We call upon law schools in Canada to require all law students to take a course in Aboriginal people and the law, which includes the history and the legacy of residential schools, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of the Indigenous Peoples, treaties and Aboriginal rights, Indigenous law, and Aboriginal Crown relations. This will require skills-based training in intercultural competency, conflict resolution, human rights, and anti-racism.
Grounded, Guided, Growing, A Time for Centering, from Scott Kearns.
One of the challenges I feel we attempt to meet here is not to, and it's even written in our guidelines for what is sung, the words that are sung or the words that are said, would not make any statement, any promise, any prediction of what could happen that we can't support as having a solid ground. And what I mean by that is Greta has a term. And I don't use that word, so I'm not going to use that word. She has a different vocabulary than me in some respects. Having grown up Baptist, I don't have that vocabulary. But United Church trained their people in different words. So anyway, she has a word for, if you've ever been in a store with an aisle with posters or plaques, and the statements all sound so sweet and lovely. Just dream it and it will happen. Or you can have anything you want and you go for it. All these kind of, she has a term for that kind of message. I won't use it. But I agree with it. I agree with her. What I would never want to say here is something you couldn't say, you couldn't offer in the middle of a Syrian refugee camp or in the middle of some tragedy somewhere. If it's true, it's got to be true everywhere. And so when we talk about grounding ourselves, it can't even be in, I ground myself in my family, because you live in an earthquake and you may not have that family. Nothing is sure about that. So we try to ground ourselves in life itself, because that is there. Life is there in all its difficulties and all its beauty. With eyes wide open, we live. We ground ourselves in the realities of life. And then we ask the question, how then shall we live? And that answer comes resounding, I hope, in the words that we sing and the words that we think in our heads while we're listening to people share here. And we really, truly do need wisdom to do that, especially since we're living in a world with Syrian refugee camps. We have to get wiser and wiser about how we love and how we love people we don't know at all. Just meeting someone from a refugee situation has changed my whole feeling inside about how would I love there? How would I love there? So this song, Need for Care, brings us to that reality, that grounded in life and guided by love, growing in wisdom.
first reading is by Rebecca Solnit, a writer. She is an associate editor of Harper's Magazine and a contributor to many other periodicals. This is a paradise of rising to the occasion that points out by contrast how the rest of the time most of us fall down from the heights of possibility down into diminished selves and dismal societies. Many now do not even hope for a better society, but they recognize it when they encounter it, and that discovery shines out even through the namelessness of their experience. Others recognize it, grasp it, and make something of it. And long-term social and political transformations, both good and bad, arise from the wreckage, offered as wisdom for the journey.
May we walk in its light.
Focused Moments from Greta Vosper.
Rebecca Solnit is the author of the book A Paradise Built in Hell, which I have been consuming over the last few weeks in preparation for this and the next couple of Sundays to come. It's a book that looks at disasters, beginning with the earthquake and fire in San Francisco in 1906 and ending with Hurricane Katrina in 1905, the reading of which reminds us that we really haven't learned a whole lot. But as noted in the reading from this morning, there is something that happens after disaster when we seem to break free of the constraints within which we live, constraints that usually we are not even aware are in existence. But we come together as community and we do extraordinary things. So the focus moment has that in mind. For a while, it froze. Staring at the wreckage, my heart turned cold as stone. Broken free of all that had formed its reality, it was nothing but a rock. Hard. Cold. Something I could use as a weapon. Something that would save me. It didn't last. The burning took over within moments, in a crucible broad and deep, filled with the too many hearts that too had frozen in fear in those moments. Together, that moment melted away, and we learned to love as we had never loved before. Our hearts fused as one, beating that all might be safe. Fed, sheltered, embraced, beating beyond disaster and into what it taught us we might be. It wasn't until yesterday when I was speaking at Don Mills United Church that the word that would hold today's perspectives together clarified itself for me, and the word was cohere. I heard myself saying it over and again during my presentation there, meeting with about 50 people who were, you know, along the spectrum between yay and are you kidding me? The idea of cohering into a whole was a significant element of that conversation, and I was talking about the United Church of Canada, about the work that we were trying to do within it, and that we cohered our understanding. So here's the definition of cohere as a verb: to be united, to form a whole. And then the example is, our mixed physical and spiritual natures cohere and mature. And synonyms are stick together, hold together, be united, bind, fuse. The stories cohere into a convincing whole. If we were having coffee today, you notice a little bit of Benjamin Moore mayonnaise dotting my skin place to place. You'll know that I've been painting. Scott and I are putting our home back together after a number of small or big problems. We moved in. I think I said I was going to invite you to a home housewarming in July, which will be the fifth anniversary of our moving in. Because so many things have gone wrong. I was sick for almost the full year when we got there. The electrical kind of went. The fire department came, told us they were gonna, unless we got all the electrical out of the basement by the end of the week, they were going to, you know, put a work order on the house. So we had to tear all the electrical out. And then, you know, it was one thing after another. Finally, the house was diagnosed with Stachybotrys. Anyone know what that is? Black mold. About just over a year ago, we had the entire basement gutted, and that helped us understand partly why I had been sick for the entire first year that we had lived there. So we are now, we've just sort of got the basement back together so that we can move back in there, and the stuff that has been in the way for the last, 13 months, in the hallway, on the staircases, in the dining room, you know, lining, folded over the railing, it's all back down in the basement, and we're getting our lives together. So we're painting things and getting things together. We're creating a space for us. We're putting a story around us that defines us, that holds us together. Keith Urban has a song in which he sings, I'll earn your trust making memories of us. When we put our stories together, when we tell stories to one another, when we connect in families or in urban tribes, as my son is more connected to his urban tribe than he is to his family, it's a new way that young people gather together and create family out of the friends that they have. When we tell ourselves that we are connected to one another, it's usually because we have stories to share, because we have memories that have built some trust in those communities. So as we are putting our home back together, we're building that story around us. I mean, it's a pretty thick story when you go through all the, you know, tragedies and disasters that have happened in the last 5 years. We've got quite a story to tell. But we continue to do that. We continue to tell stories in our lives. We come together around those stories and see one another, in one another, the people that we trust, that know us, who have brought our stories into being. March 11th this year, this week, was the 5th anniversary of the tsunami in Japan. And I want to talk about that in terms of story, not because that disaster is the biggest disaster that has befallen humanity, not because it's a specific one that has more meaning for me than other ones. There are other tragedies that have been monumental, but because it helps us to see some of the elements of what happens in people's lives when disaster occurs. And I wanted to first invite you to think, as I've just done with the idea of our home and the creation of the recreation of our home, those stories that we put around us that help us know who we are. And I wanted to ask you to name maybe one or two things that for you are part of the stories of your life that tell you who you are. What are some of those things that, if you were to say, if you were to have, you know, one of those, you know, those dating things where you sit down for, I think you've got 2 minutes to tell somebody who you are, and then you go on, you tell somebody else. Well, if you had less than 2 minutes, if you had to say two things that would tell someone about your life, about what holds your life together, what would those things be? Just call them out, and I'll repeat them so people can hear them. Sorry, Walt. Family,
adventure,
music,
art,
sports,
work,
gardening,
education,
I'm sorry, people,
quilting.
And quilting,
David,
family farm,
travel.
Those are great things. A lot of them are ones that you would be able to hold on to after some kind of a disaster. But I want to tell you the story of someone who experienced a disaster in Japan, his story of his life as it unfolded. It happened in Ukedo. I'm not going to pronounce any of these words properly, and I'll get get you to help me later. But I'm going to do my best. Ukedo, which was a fishing village predominantly on the shore that didn't really see a lot of the damage that the seas could rake over time. Generally, that happened up the coast. They had a fairly placid existence next to the sea with the fishermen that went out each morning long before the sun came up and caught their fish. And the one person about whom I'm going to speak is Kanuya San, who had been a fisherman there for years. He was 71 years old and had decided just that year that he was going to, you know, hang up his fish nets or pass his boys on to his boys or something like that. He was going to give up that life and allow someone else to do it and take his wife on a trip around Japan, if not around the world, if he was going to make it. In the last few years, the fishermen of the town had a little bit of a financial boon because TEPCO, the electrical company, had built nuclear plants, and every time that they built a new plant, they gave a bit of a bonus to the fishermen there because they were going to be letting the warm water that cooled the reactors, they were going to be letting that warm water out into the ocean. And so it was going to cost the fishermen a bit, and so they recompensed them. So he didn't really have any financial concerns. But he wouldn't have really anyway, because he was one of the best fishermen. He was broad, he was strong, and he could go out every day and bring in anywhere from 50 to 200 kilograms worth of fish, all kinds of fish, and he would bring it back in, sell it to the market, which would take it up the coast to the larger world market, Japan being one of the largest fishery markets in the world. And he would often, in the Shinto festival, no, the New Year's festival, when the fishermen who had brought in the most catch, the biggest catch through the whole year, got to lead the celebratory parade. And if he wasn't first in that line, he was in the top five almost every year. He was a fisherman of renown, and his family was known within that village. Earthquakes weren't uncommon, however. You know, it's Japan, after all. And so when the earthquake hit that day and he ran home knowing that this was something different, his wife was in the kitchen sweeping up a little bit of broken crockery and giggling and chatting with her friends. He knew, however, that there was a tsunami potential with this one. And 17 of his fellow fishermen had done what is the smartest thing to do, evidently, in a tsunami, though it would never have occurred to me. They jumped in their ships and went out into the sea because they knew that if they waited, the wave would hit them. But if they went out, they could ride the wave and be on top of the water as it raked its destruction on land. But he was so concerned about his wife that he ran back to get her, to save her. He threw her in the car and they started to drive. And as they drove, they realized that that had been the plan a whole lot of people had had. And the road, the lineups were crazy. Even though there was no one coming in the lane coming this way, the idea of acting appropriately and respectfully for everyone there, no one pulled in to the other lane to pass. They all just waited, stopping at the crossroads, though there were no cars coming, stopping at the crossroads to make sure that they could then be cleared to go away, to go through. They were so slow in making their way out of the disaster area that Kanuya-san decided that he would risk something else. There was a hill that had been designated a safe place for the elementary school. It was high enough, so he felt that if he got his wife there, they would be safe. So he took another detour, and he went up to that hill. And he and his wife got out of the car. And he could see behind him this wall, this 5 to 6 meter high wall, black, totally black, with a white froth on the top of it. He could see it coming. And he knew that they were not going to beat it, that hill they had got to was not high enough. And so he wrapped himself around a tree and held his wife to him. When the water came, it beat against him ferociously, broke his knee, and though he held as tightly as he possibly could, he let go of his wife. She disappeared in the water, And he, when the great wave was gone, he realized that she was gone. And what he says in the article that I was reading, he said there was a silence, the greatest silence he had ever known, and he listened only for her voice. He was rescued by someone going by and taken to a nearby hospital where they began to treat his knee. He had wanted to find his wife. He had looked for her, but he was fairly certain that she had not made it, and indeed she had not. She was found a couple of weeks later on a field somewhere, having been left there for 2 weeks, exposed to the elements and the animals and what might happen to a body, which in Japan is a horrific thing. Anywhere it would be a horrific thing to come across someone that you loved whose body had been left like that. But in Japan, the respect for those who are dead, to ensure that they are buried appropriately, that they are treated with respect, this is such an important thing. Their dignity is so great that Noya-san eventually led 330-some families in a lawsuit against TEPCO. Not a lawsuit that they should be recompensed for the loss of their homes, but that those who died should be given the dignity that they deserved. And the only way that that could be expressed was in an exchange of financial resources. He now lives about 50 miles north of where his town was, in a little prefabricated hut in the mountains where the snows of winter build up against the door, nowhere near the temperate beauty of the town that he had known, a temperate beauty which is now only temperate, the beauty having been beaten out of it. His story is a story of thousands and thousands and thousands who, as they fled that tsunami, lost those that they love. As they tried to recover from it, couldn't walk away from the tragedy and terror that they had experienced during that time. Couldn't find the way to offer dignity. He keeps his wife's ashes in a little place that he has set up in that prefab house because he will not bury them until he can get them to the cemetery that he wants to bury them in, which, if you hold a Geiger counter to the ground, fires off at an incredible number, way beyond anything that even those working in the nuclear industry would consider safe. That land has been deserted and will be deserted until they can enclose it in some kind of forever safety thing that might keep it safe. A few years ago, Scott and I were watching a TV show on Netflix called Touch. It's a story about this young boy who had these abilities to perceive numerical symmetries and find people who were in need because of fractures in those symmetries. When there was a rift somewhere, he felt that rift physically, and he would try to fix it and convince his father, Kiefer Sutherland, who his main vocabulary was as he was constantly running after his kid trying to keep up. But anyway, the kid was brilliant. He was on the autism spectrum some way, never talked, didn't talk through the whole thing. But in one of the episodes, you meet a woman who is also looking for her child, who also has the same kind of numerical thing that she can interpret, those rifts in what the world is to be like, and they can interpret them. And you meet her when she's on a beach. And there's a guy on the beach who is collecting stuff. He's walking the beach up and down, and he's collecting all these interesting things. And she gets talking to him, and he talks with her a little bit, and it turns out that he's picking up stuff that has come across the ocean from the tsunami in Japan. It loosed of its moorings, loosed of the stories that had tied it to people's lives, loosed of the communities and the value that it had at some point in time. It had drifted across the ocean and found its way to the coast of North America some way. And she is disgusted because he's putting this stuff online. And she's revolted by the fact that he would take advantage of that kind of horror and tragedy and turn it into his own personal profit, selling souvenirs of the wreckage of Japan. But it turns out that what he's doing is adding to a database of materials that people have found floating on their shorelines, so that people in Japan can maybe find something that was theirs and bring it home. And I've got, Peter has some slides that I'm going to show you. I'm going to tell you some stories about five of those things. Peter, can you bring up, you probably can't even see that. It's showing little lines that go from Japan up to Alaska, British Columbia, and California and Hawaii. So if you can bring up the next picture. Nothing like a Harley-Davidson to survive, right? The Harley-Davidson was found along the coast of North America, sealed in a compartment in which it was normally stored. So its owner had kept it in this little compartment, like a, I guess it's a bike garage, and it had floated its way across the ocean. Most of the debris, tons and tons of it, had sunk probably to the bottom of the ocean. A lot of it is believed to be in the Great Pacific Garbage Dump, that collection of debris that has accumulated and that travels around the Pacific. But these things that did actually get to the other side have been picked up by people and often returned to their owners. The owner of this motorbike, as soon as he saw the picture of it, he knew exactly that it was his bike. He recognized it immediately. And they worked, the people who found it, and he worked together to try to get it back to Japan. But in the end, he decided that it needed to go to the Harley-Davidson Museum in America as a symbol and a tribute to everyone who had survived, everyone who had been lost, and of the stories that would be told but never end about that reality. So this motorbike is now in the Harley-Davidson Museum. The next picture is the picture of a sign. The sign is about a housing community in one of the villages, and it was found in Hawaii and someone discerned what it meant, and they connected with the community and took it back to that community, which to this day is trying to find their way forward, to build new stories that make sense, that will bring their hearts back to home. And so it stands there as a reminder that that can happen, that there was something before and we can make something now. So it has been returned. The next slide is a picture of a soccer ball. This young boy, whose soccer ball this was, had it returned to him because it has his name and it has a date and it says best wishes on it. It was given to him by his school when he was leaving his school and moving to a new community. It's the only thing in his life that has been returned to him, in the lives of him and everyone in his family. That soccer ball is the only thing from those stories that went before that he now has, and it has been returned to him, so he has it with him. And the next one is a picture of, can you tell what that is? It's a boat. It's a boat covered with barnacles, because it, of course, had floated across the ocean all that time. But the next picture shows that kids at a school scraped the barnacles off and could see the name on that boat. And the boat belonged to a high school. And so they have managed to connect those two schools together. They've had exchange trips. They've got to know each other. They've started to bring together new stories out of that loss, returning that boat. And then there's one more, a boat that showed up that was just this thing on the horizon, and it turned out to be a shrimp boat that was too dangerous to be left there and too dangerous to be boarded, so it was eventually sunk. It was floating around within a shipping laneway, and so it needed to be sunk. And it, in its own way, is a symbol of some of the things that happened in Japan at that time. The stories that come out of the tsunami are stories about loss, about trying to find new stories, stories about losing that coherence that we have known, about trying to cohere new lives together. Gretel Ehrlich wrote a book called The Wave, A Journey in the Wake of the Tsunami. And it's really a story of several lives of people who exist now beyond, tell the story of what was before, and find their way toward the future. It's inspiring, breathtakingly beautiful, earth and heart-shatteringly tragic, and filled with such strength that the word coherence becomes palpable as you read it. And I wanted to read one piece out of that. First, a poem by Kodojin. White clouds, void is form. Red leaves, form is void. White clouds and red leaves, all swept away by an evening's wind. And then from Ehrlich. The ocean holds the streams of stories. The wave came to carry them, empty them of meaning. The power of the water pulling back, bearing the ocean floor, took all the loose ends, the beginnings and endings, and unraveled them, recomposing stories so they had no familiar shapes. Some were all endings with no middles. Others were so shapeless, there was no way to tell how they had started or if they could end. The wave was center and fringe at once, a totality, both destructive and beautiful. Oceans of story were taken up by it. Roof beams and window frames were whittled back to the trees from which they came. The furrowed ocean cleaved land and knifed the wavering ribbons of each human and animal story. Every day, Rebecca Solnit says, every day is a disaster. Every day we walk into moments that we didn't expect. We end up in lives we hadn't asked for. We run into unresolved stuff from way back forgotten, and it takes us down. But we have the ability to cohere a new story, even if only within ourselves, despite that BS aisle in HomeSense. We have the ability to cohere a new story of those fragments, those pieces that are shattered when we walk into disaster, as we will today and tomorrow and the day after. And the thing that happens in disaster that is so common is that, broken free of what we think we're supposed to be, broken free of the way we live together in these well-defined institutional or political or environmental ways that we are to live, broken free of that, we discover so much more about ourselves. Our disasters teach us who we are. And we have in the midst of them the opportunity to come out as someone else. Most of the time, we don't have the courage to do that. Most of the time, those things that are rigid around us are so significant, yep, you were supposed to turn your clock, Jim. Most of the time, when we have that opportunity to let go of what was and step into who we are and what could be, we run up against the rigidity of who people think we are. We run up against the expectations of how we're to function in society. We run up against the who I am in my family. I have to be that for them. We run up against so many suppositions about who we are that we don't let disaster offer us the best gift it can offer. A new day, a new heart, a new life, a new you. A new possibility to cohere beyond what has been told to you and into what you may yet be. In the disaster that unfolded on March 11th, 5 years ago, lives were destroyed. Thousands of lives were lost. They estimate another 3,500 have been lost since then as a result of the tsunami, suicides and illnesses, and people who couldn't survive the destruction their bodies had experienced. Thousands and thousands and thousands are still displaced, will never get back to the places that were home. Others still search for those that most people recognize are long since gone. Those disasters, they're monumental. And the opportunities that happen in them are as powerful as the opportunities that can happen in us. They see a different tomorrow. They see a new possibility. They reach out beyond the strictures of society. May we come to study our own little disasters, our daily realities, in such a way that we are prepared. If we ever were to walk into some great disaster, that we would be prepared to live into that with a permission that we never felt before, with a permission that might bring about a coherence that we have never known. Thank you. Most of the disasters of disaster happen after the disaster. They happen when we don't take advantage of what it has opened up in our lives, opened up in our communities, opened up in our world. They happen when we go back into whatever shell we were living in at the time. So I invite you to approach every day as the possibility of being broken open. And in your being broken open, to expose to and invite those around you to examine the truth of who you are, raw and tragic and dismantled as you may be, so that the relationships that cohere from that moment forward may tell a story of truth, a story of beauty, and build a story of goodness that we must know. So go to that work. Be in the disaster that is you. And come out changed and loved and ready to make the world a beautiful place. Go from this place in peace.
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.